Greetings and hyper-iterative resolutions, my oceanically metronic listeners, and welcome to this August 2017 Science News Update. I'm your host for this subcutaneously exasperating science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Welcome to the dog days of summer. I've spent the last 2 weeks in Alaska, where dogs do not get their summer days. The first week, I attended the annual Plant Growth Regulatory Society of America conference in Anchorage, and the second week, I was just a tourist. The most wild part of the United States was lovely and amazing, but my favorite part was the average temperature of about 60 degrees Fahrenheit every day. It went into the 50s and even 40s at night. Many of you warm weather lovers out there may think me insane, but I treasured my time in Alaska more than I did any trip to Hawaii, probably because I never sweat once while I was in Alaska. I guess I'm just cold-blooded.
Before I go on with any science story, let me make some remarks about the Plant Growth Substances Conference that I attended in Anchorage. I was more than a bit disappointed at the Plant Growth Regulatory Society of America's conference this year. Perhaps I was oversensitized by the novel I was reading during the conference. More on that in a second. As far as I can see, the PGRSA has pretty much become a platform for the chemical industry that provides herbicides, pesticides, fungicides, and artificial growth enhancers and inducers. Most of the scientists attending were from industry, not from academia. Most of these scientists gave talks about how this or that artificial chemical, not found in nature, would enhance growth of just about any crop you can think of, from garden flowers to grapes. There was actually a plenary talk from a government wonk who described for 50 minutes how best to get your new questionable compound accepted for use by the FDA or the USDA, and I was, well, less than charmed, to say the least. When I presented my own work on the molecular evolution of a particular gene that helps regulate plant growth, I was stared at like I had grown another head. When the inevitable questions came about the practical use of such research, I rather hotly answered that the basic research into the nature of the universe does not need a practical use, and that did not win me many points. As I said, my reading material at the time didn't help. I was reading one of Neal Stephenson's first novels from a good 25 years ago, called Zodiac. Now, I will admit that I stupidly avoided this novel in the past because I thought it was another story about these Zodiac mass murderers out in the western U.S. It's not. It's actually quite a good story about Greenpeace, just called the G Organization here, an ecological disaster, and a rather good mystery, actually. The story is set in the post-Reagan decade when the EPA did not yet have any teeth, although scarily we may be going back to that era with good President Trump. The protagonist of the story is a Greenpeace environmental chemist who tracks down toxic dumping from huge industrial companies and forces them to clean up their messes by shaming tactics in the media. If you read this book, you'll learn a boatload about not just environmental chemistry, but about some of the most toxic chemicals ever to be made by man, and some positive aspects of Greenpeace, which you may have been ignorant of. Oh, and Zodiac refers to the Zodiac boats, which Greenpeace regularly uses for transport of their supporters. At any rate, all the book did in my hands was to build up a huge annoyance in me against the idiots who create barely tested toxic compounds, spray them on our foods, and then sit back and watch the profits roll in. I'm not really sure I can support the PGRSA anymore if it continues to be monetarily supported by these companies. Oh, and if you think my anger is misdirected, just listen to the first story of the evening.
For years, scientists have been amassing evidence that neonicotinoids, these are insecticides meant to keep insect pests off of agricultural crops, are also harming essential pollinators, that is, bees. But laboratory studies are limited and real-world simulations have been rather lacking. A new large field study was published at the end of June in the journal Science, and it largely confirms that neonicotinoids are indeed quite bad for bees. A three-country European field study led by Dr. Richard Pywell from the Center for Ecology and Hydrology in the UK reports that neonicotinoid exposure generally reduces the honeybee's ability to survive the winter and reduces the reproductive success of wild bees. In the European study, the researchers were interested in how the neonicotinoid exposure affects honeybees' ability to survive winter, since that's really the key to colony health, just how well they can survive the bad weather. In Hungary, the insecticide-exposed honeybee colonies had 24% fewer workers than control colonies after the winter. In the UK, colony mortality was so high, with numerous colonies totally wiped out, including many of the controls, that they could not statistically analyze them. In Germany, on the other hand, neonicotinoid exposure did not seem to affect honeybees' ability to survive the winter quite so much. Pywell says, quote, "In Hungary and the UK, where we found this negative effect of neonicotinoids, the pollen load analysis suggested that canola plants make up a far greater proportion of the honeybee's diet compared to Germany. We think that actually influences the amount of exposure that bees are getting to neonicotinoids," unquote. Pywell finishes with, quote, "I think it's reached a point now where no reasonable person would deny that these chemicals are impacting on bees one way or another. Obviously, scientists would like to do more research, but at some point, you have to make a decision. And it seems to me that a pretty obvious decision needs to be made." Unquote. The use of neonicotinoids on flowering plants has been illegal in the European Union since 2013. And the European Parliament is now debating an even broader neonicotinoid ban against all uses outside of greenhouses. And unfortunately, as usual, the United States is lagging way far behind. Thank you, U.S. Congress, for once again ignoring really, really important environmental issues.
Next story of the night. For those of you who follow Starship Sofa on Facebook, you may have noticed this story that was posted by one of our listeners, Steve Trower, several weeks ago. You may remember a couple of months back that I talked about a writer spoofing a predatory journal with a story based on an episode of the TV show Seinfeld. Remember, it was about the kidney disease where Jerry would die if he didn't urinate immediately? Anyway, Steve found a similar, more recent story of spoofing, and he thought I should hear about it. And I'm passing it on to you. See, the peer review process is a system that's used to weed out weak scientific research, using independent peers to check whether a study is legitimate or not, whether it's credible, and whether it has decent quality. But recent years have seen a rise in so-called predatory journals, where it's significantly easier to get past the reviewing process and have research quickly published. Often for a small price, of course. To once again highlight the evils of predatory journals, a blogging neuroscientist who calls himself Neuroskeptic tricked multiple scientific journals into publishing a nonsensical piece of research, dotted with massive factual errors, plagiarism, and Star Wars references. Neuroskeptic wrote about his experiment in a blog post for Discover magazine last month. The hoax paper was all about midichlorians. You may remember midichlorians as the hated device that George Lucas created for his first Star Wars prequel, The Phantom Menace, to explain how some people could sense and control the Force and others could not. Midichlorians are supposed to be some sort of life form that allows for that Force ability. Ew. Anyway, the science articles that were submitted were about a microscopic life form that resides within all living cells. The paper was submitted under the names Dr. Lucas McGeorge and Dr. Annette Kim. And it's pretty convincing sounding neuroscience, mostly. But at one point, embedded in this so-called science jargon, the paper states, quote, "Did you ever hear the tragedy of Darth Plagueis the Wise? I thought not. It is not a story the Jedi would tell you. It was a Sith legend. Darth Plagueis was a Dark Lord of the Sith, so powerful and so wise, he could use the Force to influence the midichlorians to create life." Unquote. Apparently, four predatory journals fell for this sting. The International Journal of Molecular Biology, open access, the Austin Journal of Pharmacology and Therapeutics, the American Research Journal of Biosciences, oh, and the American Journal of Medical and Biological Research also accepted the paper. However, they asked for a $360 fee up front, which the author declined to pay. This is not the first time, and probably won't be the last time, a journal has fallen for a setup like this. Earlier this year, a fake scientist called Anna Ozurst, Ozurst is fraud in Polish, managed to get on the editorial board of dozens of academic journals, despite not even having any qualifications, or, well, actually existing. The shady practices of predatory journals are the dark side of open access journals. In the widest sense, open access means that you and I can read research online without having to pay a hefty subscription fee to the journal. Since they don't rely on subscriptions to generate income, they often ask the researchers to pay a fee to publish. With the rise of the internet, the open access movement has gained huge momentum, with more of these journals seeing the model as a more democratic way to spread knowledge and the fruits of research. However, as neuroskeptics' antics have highlighted once more, this idealistic system can be exploited. Next story. Darwin actually did more than just propose earth-shattering new theories. He was a real biologist. So in 1834, Darwin discovered fossils in Argentina from an odd creature later named Macrauchenia pataconica by paleontologist Richard Owen, who examined the bones long after Darwin's return to England. Darwin initially speculated that the extinct animal might be a mastodon, but Owen believed it more likely resembled a llama or a camel. So over the years, fossil analysis has suggested that Macrauchenia was quite large, possibly 10 feet tall, possibly weighing over a ton, with a camel-like body, supporting Owen's view, and a short elephant-like trunk for a nose. Unfortunately, even with the help of modern technology, scientists were unable to determine Macrauchenia's relatedness to any known species or to assign it to any specific evolutionary lineage. Now, doctors Mickey Hofreiter of the University of Potsdam, Germany, and Ross McPhee of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City have finally figured out where Macrauchenia lies in the evolution of mammals and what it may be related to, and they published their work last month in Nature Communications. They figured out all this by sequencing ancient DNA from partially fossilized bone specimens of Macrauchenia. McPhee says, quote, "We had a difficult problem to solve here. Macrauchenia doesn't have any really close living relatives. Because ancient DNA is so degraded and full of unwanted environmental DNA, we had to rely on being able to use genomes of close relatives as a kind of scaffold to reconstruct fossil sequences," unquote. McPhee says that in addition to no relatives, they had low-quality DNA from temperate areas. To make matters worse, so they devised a new approach involving repeated overlapping mapping that relies on using very strict parameters and the mitochondrial genomes of a number of living species as multiple reference points to more reliably predict the fossils' most likely genetic sequences. After initially mapping sequences from a distantly related modern species, the researchers generated a consensus sequence that they used as the new reference sequence. This consensus reference sequence was updated over multiple iterations in the mapping process until all available reads were mapped. And after careful optimization of the technique, the authors finally generated an assembly that covered about 80% of the Macrauchenia's mitochondrial genome. McPhee says, quote, "Our study found that the closest living relatives of Macrauchenia are in the placental order known as Perissodactyla, which includes horses, rhinos, and tapirs. Unquote. Having verified the taxonomy of Macrucania among known species, the authors used the mitochondrial sequence and molecular clock analysis to determine that the species diverged from other members of the order Perissodactyla about 66 million years ago. And this timing corresponds with the end of the Mesozoic era, which is marked by mass extinctions of dinosaurs, and the beginning of the current Cenozoic era. The next two stories are kind of related to each other because they have to do with hair growth, which I'm finding of more interest as I grow older. The first hair story comes from the July issue of the journal Cell. Again, we have a story that suggests that microbiomes are important for some physiological reason. This story suggests that, well, microbes help your hair to grow. Huh. Well, older humans are especially obsessed with their hair. From grooming to styling to trying to regrow what's been lost, we spend lots of money, lots of time every year on our hair. Now, Dr. Tiffany Scharschmidt from the University of California reports about the strange relationship between bacteria and hair. Regulatory T cells are a kind of immune cell that enables the body to tolerate commensal microbes. Scharschmidt has found a relationship between hair growth and these T cells and bacteria. Scharschmidt first created a mouse model by removing regulated T cells from the skin of mice. Then, she shaved a patch of skin on these mice and also on wild-type mice, and they were surprised to find that the hair did not grow back in mice that did not have any skin T cells. Using microscopic imaging of skin samples from mice with labeled T cells, Scharschmidt found that Tregs, as they're called, regulatory T cells, accumulated around follicle stem cells, and that the number of T cells in this area tripled as the follicles entered growth phase. Removing these T regulatory cells during the hair growth process had no effect, indicating that the cells are most important at the beginning of the growth phase, not when it's actually started. Mice without hair, or those that were germ-free, showed very little accumulation of T cells at their hair follicles. This further revealed how the presence of bacteria is essential to T cell accumulation and hair growth. No bacteria, no hair growth. Scharschmidt found that when T cells accumulate at the hair follicles, they prompt stem cells in the area to express cytokine CCL20 and its receptor CCR6. Commensal microbes influence how T cells accumulate, which in turn influences CCL20 expression from hair follicles, ultimately affecting T cell migration. In short, commensal microbes push hair follicles to release a chemokine that directs these T regulatory cells into the neonatal skin, and then the T regulatory cells stimulate the hair growth. These findings offer further understanding of the microbe-host interaction as well as new insights into how the human microbiome affects hair growth and development. For us humans, whose hair is so precious and personal, this relationship might hit a little closer to home than previously thought. So the upshot is we need bacteria to help our hair grow. This is very cool, but probably not helpful at all for the follically challenged out there. So can anything be done to force your balding head to grow hair? Well, Dr. Chi Cheng Chen, Taipei Veterans Hospital, has also published a hair growth paper in the journal Cell last month. Chen suggests that micro-injuries to the scalp can actually stimulate hair growth. Chen points out that studies from as early as 1918 show that plucking hair can potentially lead to degeneration. But details of how this can happen have never been fully explored. Now Chen reports that hair stem cell activation depends on signaling from nearby follicles. Chen states, quote, "By varying the spacing, arrangement, and shapes of plucked regions, we unexpectedly found that plucking 200 hairs with a proper topical distribution can cause up to 1,200 hairs to regenerate," unquote. For hairs plucked in regions greater than 6 millimeters in diameter on mice, there was no hair regeneration at all. Removing 200 hairs from a 2.4 millimeter region which meant 100% of the hairs were plucked, the authors saw regeneration of only the missing hairs. But for regions 3 millimeters to 5 millimeters in diameter, the mice not only regrew the plucked follicles, but actually produced up to 1,300 new hairs surrounding the area that was plucked. Chen hypothesized that injured follicles produce a signal capable of traveling to the surrounding follicles. He reasons that the regeneration of plucked and unplucked follicles depends upon the threshold level of the signal, and that the response of the region would be determined by the density and position of other plucked follicles. In other words, this looks like classic quorum sensing. So what's quorum sensing, you may ask? Well, quorum sensing is a process by which cells, or microscopic organisms, work together in a community and make collective decisions in response to stimuli that affect only some of the members of that community. The phenomenon has been demonstrated in bacteria and yeast, and even in ants and bees. To explore the potential role for quorum sensing in hair regeneration, the authors looked at skin gene expression at 4 time points after plucking. The data showed that cells respond initially to plucking by releasing inflammatory cytokines, which recruit macrophage cells from the immune system to the injury. Gene expression changes also mirrored reactivation of hair growth pathways and an increase of tumor necrosis factor TNF-alpha. The authors confirmed the roles of a particular cytokine called CCL2 as the initial distress signal sent by the damaged follicles, and tumor necrosis factor alpha in promoting the actual hair regeneration. Chen believes that, quote, quorum sensing circuit we describe in our paper provides a way for injured hair follicles to collectively assess the magnitude and extent of injury that the skin has sustained and make an all-or-none decision whether or not to regenerate, unquote. Presumably, this can be used to stimulate hair growth in the follically challenged. We shall see in the future. Perhaps plucking does have value here, although it sounds like it has to be done in a very precise manner in order to get the results that Chen has found.
The last story of the evening would make a fan of the SF author Greg Bear jump up and down in excitement. Several decades ago, Bear wrote a short story and later a full-length novel called Blood Music. Blood Music is an amazingly prescient story in which the protagonist is able to take blood cells and use the DNA inside as computer memory storage as well as microscopic computers. This doesn't sound like much of a plot to begin with, but it gets interesting when the researcher's project is shut down and he tries to, well, kind of stupidly, smuggle out the programmable cells from his lab. So I have kind of put you on the edge of your seats now, right? Has somebody produced cell-sized computers? Not really. However, a group of researchers have been able to make progress at storing memory information in bacterial cells, which, by the way, are even smaller than blood cells, and they have much less DNA, too. Dr. Seth Shipman of Harvard Medical School wants to turn cells into, well, little microscopic historians that will record information over time. He and his colleagues have published their results on this project in the July 12th issue of the journal Nature. Shipman released a short movie. I know at this point you're going, what, a movie? What are you talking about? But this movie was stored in a bacterial cell. It's a brief proof-of-concept movie, a sequence of images that illustrate how DNA can be employed to store digital information and then played back again from living cells. Shipman says, quote, "We envision a biological memory system that's much smaller and more versatile than today's technologies, which will track many events in a cell's life non-intrusively over time," unquote. This is an amazing idea. The ability to record such sequential events like a movie at the molecular level will be the key to sort of reinventing the very concept of recording using molecular engineering. In Shipman's scheme, cells themselves could be induced to record molecular events, like changes in gene expression over time, in their own genomes. Then the information could be retrieved simply by sequencing the genomes of the cells that it was stored in. And the title of their article in Nature was, quote, CRISPR-Cas encoding of a digital movie into the genomes of a population of living bacteria, unquote. Haha. So there, once again, we are in CRISPR-Cas territory. If you don't remember what that is, it's an enzymatic method that allows targeted rewriting of a genome of a cell. Among the editing possibilities that have been discovered or invented, CRISPR-Cas gives researchers the ability to write information into the genome of a living cell by the addition of nucleotides over time. Shipman explains how they use the editing system to store the movie in the bacterial cell. Quote, here we use the CRISPR-Cas system to encode the pixel values of black and white images and a short movie into the genomes of a population of living bacteria. In doing so, we push the technical limits of this information storage and optimize strategies to minimize their limitations, unquote. The Harvard team first demonstrated it could encode and retrieve a single image of a human hand in DNA, and they inserted that image into bacteria. They then did the same thing, but with a series of similarly encoded and reconstructed frames of the classic 1870s horse race in motion sequence of photos, an early forerunner to moving pictures. So we're not actually talking Titanic here or anything. We're talking a very simple series of photographic images, which make up a very short movie. To create the movie, the researchers translated 5 frames from the original horse race movie into DNA. Over the course of 5 days, they sequentially treated bacteria with frame after frame of translated DNA. Afterwards, they reconstructed the movie with 90% accuracy by sequencing the bacterial DNA. In future work, Shipman says that his group will focus on establishing molecular recording devices in other cell types and on further engineering the system so it can memorize biological information. Shipman finishes with saying, quote, one day we may be able to follow all the developmental decisions that a differentiating neuron is taking from an early stem cell to a highly specialized type of cell in the brain, leading to a better understanding of how basic biological and developmental processes are choreographed, unquote. By the way, Dr. Shipman, you may want to avoid accidentally or purposely injecting any of those cells. Alas, like the protagonist of Blood Music, you never quite can tell what the results of that might be.
Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care. Make sure your scalp has plenty of bacteria. Be careful plucking your hairs, except under a doctor's supervision. Start considering organic foods as an alternative. Keep watching the skies. I hope I've inspired some of you. Before I sign off, it's my understanding that this week celebrates Starship Sofa's 500th episode. I guess the Tony Smith and company in the end decided not to have any super special stuff going on as promised earlier. But I do want to say congratulations. I have been with the Starship Sofa crew for much of its voyage over these last few years, and I have been quite pleased in general with what has been created by all of us. Tony wants to see us go to 1,000 episodes, which means another 10 years or so of interstellar travel. Tony is a tough guy, and I have no doubt that he will hold out that long, along with the sofa. But we'll see if I hold out that long. At any rate, until next time, this is Jim Campanella.